This is Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name is David Inch. Good morning. Welcome back for the second hour of the show. This morning, we are pleased to have with us Jean Owl. She is the author of a series of best-selling novels about the early history of humankind. Her first book was The Clan of the Cave Bear. That was published in 1980. That was followed by Valley of the Horses, The Mammoth Hunters, and her most recent book, which was published last year, is entitled The Plains of Passage. Her first three books have sold more than 5 million copies each in the United States and in Canada. They're published in 22 foreign editions. Her newest book is doing equally well, and she is now at work on a fifth volume in what is planned as a six-part series. As you may know, her first book, Clan of the Cave Bear, was made into a major motion picture. As a matter of fact, I was told it was just on cable just recently. She's sneering, so we may have to ask her about that. Her books concentrate mostly on the story of a woman named Ayla, who is separated from her people and her parents by an earthquake in the first book, Clan of the Cave Bear, and then she comes to meet up with a group of people who are not like her, who raise her and take care of her. She grows into adulthood, and the subsequent books are about her travels in the landscape of Ice Age Europe, her meeting with the man who becomes her mate, and their search for the place that can really be their home. That is in just in small part what her stories are about. And you may be familiar with them. They certainly have been very, very popular, especially, I'm told, on university campuses. They're popular with college kids. If you would like to talk with us as we talk about her writing, you can certainly pick up the telephone and give us a call. We'd also like you to know, by the way, she is in Champaign-Urbana to give a talk in the MillerCom series. She'll talk about her writing this evening at 8 o'clock in the Follinger Auditorium on the U of I campus, and that is free and open to anyone who would like to attend. She is also going to be doing a book signing this afternoon from 2 to 4 at the University YWCA, which is very close to our studios here on Wright Street. So if you would like to meet her, you can do that. Thank you very much for coming to talk with us.
Thank you for having me. This is great.
Perhaps I should give my telephone number here again. It's locally 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL if you'd like to call in. Well, certainly when you take a look at your books, it becomes very obvious that you have done a good deal of research.
Yes.
On the people that you write about. And there is there's tremendous detail about all aspects of their lives and the kinds of objects that they made and used and how they hunted and what they ate and their religious practices and just a tremendous wealth of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Something, though, that I'm interested in hearing you talk about is something that is not so concrete. It's not something you can go to a museum and look at, and that is personality.
Yes.
And I suppose if one was of a mind to be critical, and I think maybe some people have raised this criticism, they would say, well, you got the other stuff right, but that what you have done is you've basically taken modern people and dress them
in
skins.
Absolutely, and on purpose and with purpose of foresight. Because the whole point that I'm trying to make here is that people who lived in Upper Paleolithic Europe during the Ice Age, the ones that we call Cro-Magnon, were modern people. They had the same kinds of emotional responses, psychological reactions, intelligence range, talents, abilities. What was different is the world that they lived in. So there's no reason that those people would not have at some point in time considered what was their purpose in being there, what was their reason for living. They would not have suffered over loves and hates, dreams, ambitions, hopes, sorrows. That's the whole point.
Hmm.
I'm trying to show you that these people could have been your college roommate, your neighbor's son, your next-door neighbor, your friend. And the way that I'm doing that, I mean, I'm trying to get beyond the stereotype that these were somehow ugga-mugga savages.
Hmm.
Because even anthropologists will tell you today that the contemporary hunter-gatherer societies that may still be left or that there were until recent times were far more complex, far more modern in their sensibilities than we tend to think.
Well, how do we know that? What are the indications from the you know the physical record, the things that we can see and touch, that gives you some insight into what the inner life of these people was like?
Okay, well, first of all, I have to say that we know from looking at their skeletons that they had exactly the same skeletons that we do. Then we have to take a look at their physical culture. You take a look at the art, and you take a look at the artifacts, and you take a look at the many, many things that, and when we're talking about, for example, Eastern Europe, which the Mammoth Hunters was set, and that's the beginning of the Plains of Passage, that's where they start from. There's interesting kinds of things that you can look at. You can look at the way that they constructed their houses. Okay, now they lived in what was essentially a treeless open plain, grassy plains, right? So you're looking at, and they were huge, what they call megafauna, mammoths and various other animals. And their bones would oftentimes accumulate in places. You know, they would get washed away in the spring floods or whatever. And when they would die natural deaths very often, sometimes they hunted them, but a lot of times the bones would accumulate at certain bends of the river. And the people often built their houses near their lumber yard because they used those bones as the construction materials, as the framing, if you will. But they not only just used them in a haphazard way. Places like Meseritch and Mezin show, for example, the lower mandible, you know, the lower jaw of the mammoth, which is this V-shaped bone. And they were found, you know, with one of them stacked on top of another and showing this sort of a what we call a chevron, in other words, you know, a V-shaped thing, and then another one on top of that.
Like sergeant stripes.
Yes. And then they might have one next to it that was stacked in the same way or maybe upside down, so you'd get the zigzag effect, you know. And there was very, very much a design concept. We're talking about the beginnings of architecture here. You take a look at the fact that they had, usually these structures were in a settlement kind of, I mean, these were not totally nomadic people. And you can find artwork, you can find carving, and you can find art that is oftentimes what we would call contemporary modern art. Some of it's very, very representational and very good. Some of the figurines are like, you find figurines of women bird shapes. They look like they're transforming, you know, and you can look at that and say, why would somebody think of that? Well, that's a very modern kind of a concept. But I suppose with all of the things that you can find, and you know that they're human, and you can take a look at burials, and you can see all kinds of grave goods. One of the things I suppose that I would ask you is, what would make you think that they're not? I mean, what have you learned in your lifetime that would make you think that these were somehow less modern than if they are totally modern in their physical skeleton? Why would you think that they're less? And I think it's because we're still indoctrinated with that 19th century Victorian antiquarian theory that somehow these people were some kind of a missing link, and we can't get beyond that.
We're talking this morning with author Jean Owl, author of a number of books. Her first, The Clan of the Cave Bear, and the others in a series that are called, is it Earth's Children?
Earth's Children.
And the newest one is The Plains of Passage that just came out last year. She's here in Champaign-Urbana to talk about her writing, and we'd be very happy to talk with you, too. We'd have one person here we'll get right to, and others, if you're out there, you'd like to call in, talk with our guest, please do dial the number 333-9455. That's the local number, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, here's someone to talk with on our toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I have a question that's perplexed me for some time.
Okay.
The other day on the news about Iran, when they had overcome, you know, the Iraqis and they were in retreat,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There was an American troop carrier or something that stopped and was talking to a shepherd by the Euphrates River.
Mm-hmm.
The man didn't even know who they were, where America was, or even that there was a war going on. It wasn't comical. It was so odd that all this would be happening and he would have no knowledge of it. The thought struck me, as it has so often with people like this, is this man is living as he has probably lived for 5 or 6 or 7,000 years
mm-hmm.
without a single change in his life technologically. And I was wondering, you know, in your studies, have you ever pondered the reason why certain peoples never advance? And I mean that strictly in a technological sense. I know mm-hmm. there are many worthwhile values that we have lost that they maintain. But why is it that cultures, as neighbors sometimes, will sit next to one another for thousands of years, and one, like Northern Europeans, will shoot so far ahead in a technological sense, and a few hundred miles to the south, they will be literally living as they lived when man first emerged?
Well, I can only make guesses. You know, those are very fascinating, interesting, almost philosophical questions. And I can make some guesses, and probably a lot of it has to do with communication, has to do with interaction, has to do with the culture that they have evolved in, and whether or not their culture fosters interaction with people who are nearby. It is a very interesting concept, and when you say 5 or 6,000 years, that seems like a long time to us, but when you're talking about human evolution, you really have to take it much longer than that.
Yes.
The people I'm writing about are probably somewhere 25, 35,000 years ago, and I'm not specifying. But, you know, earliest hominids evolved somewhere around 4 million. And that's where you really begin to see some interesting things. When you talk about unchanging, one of the things that came home to me this summer, I spent 3.5 months in France looking around where the Dordogne region, where the painted caves are and so on, and even spent a week at a dig, which was kind of interesting and very enlightening for me. But at the site next to the one, there was the one that they had just finished digging a couple of years back, they had actually found Neanderthal remains dating back to about 300,000 years in France. And at another site, they're sort of going back and reevaluating and redating and rechecking the site. And they're finding out that apparently the Neanderthal were very, very unchanging for something like, they're finding what they would call classic Neanderthal tools going back 250 to 300,000 years. I'm not even sure if this is published yet, but this is what Jean-Philippe Rigaud, who is the one who was in charge of it, was talking about. And so if you're asking about unchanging times, of course, I suspect that that's what prompted Stephen Gould to come up with this punctuated equilibrium theory. But I think that if things are going along fine, you don't have a tendency to change.
Have you been, a couple summers ago, we were down in southern France near Perpignan.
Yeah.
There's a little town, Van Gros,
mm-hmm.
and there was a dig going on up in the mountains there. The men, well, it was the school that was running it, but the man we were talking to said that they expected this date to go to 500,000.
They probably were looking at Homo erectus. Probably looking somewhat earlier than Neanderthal, although that again, those transitions are difficult to date.
Yeah.
I mean, when did we change? When did modern humans evolve? Well, that question's sort of being popped around right now. When was there a change from Homo erectus to Neanderthal? Well, those dates are still up for question.
Well, are you suggesting that there are between these groups of people that I've called neighbors, that there is actually a difference in the human...
No, not today. I'm just saying there's a difference in culture.
Right.
I'm not suggesting anymore that there's any difference in basic human qualities and so on. I'm saying there's a difference in culture.
Let me ask you this. In your stories, you look at Northern Europeans kind of...
Yes.
..as a state of being such as the American Indians might have been in the 1800s.
Or maybe as the pioneers, in a sense.
Pardon me?
When we're talking about the Cro-Magnon, we're talking about the people who moved into the country from some other place, generally speaking. So probably from the east. And so I have almost a sensitivity of the early pioneers much as the Native Americans.
But the technology, the social structure was similar to what we look at.
Well, the technology is.
Yes.
The technology, that we can be fairly certain of.
Were you to take, as Alex Haley did in Roots, and take Isla, all the way
Isla.
Through, her 1,000 generations, at what point do we see, would we see a distinct change, and we say this is what we would look back, you know, and say, well, an Elizabethan person is, compared to the early books, a modern person. At what point would that happen?
I'm not sure if I understand. What do you mean? At what point did, was, is there a physical change in the body?
No. It's, to me, as I read through history, there suddenly appears what I would call a modern person. For example, a pharaoh I would consider a modern person. That is a bureaucracy. They have an army. They have to begin.
You're talking about then the change from hunter-gatherer societies into the beginnings of agriculture, for example, the Neolithic, going from the Paleolithic to the Neolithic.
Right. At what point in time would that happen?
Well, it depends. It's somewhere between 7 and 10,000. It depends upon what part of the world you're talking about.
Uh-huh.
You're talking about domestication of plants, or you're talking about domestication of animals. And my own guess of that, of course, is that was about the time that the ice really fully receded from the last ice age, about 10, 11, 12,000 years ago. And that was when suddenly the climate was so different, and the way, you know, when we were an ice age society, it was a very rich, easy to hunt in kind of world. It was broad grassy plains, and it fed uncounted numbers of herds of animals. There were a lot of changes as the ice receded, and some of those changes were very, very difficult. Going through some really, and people moved, you know, they moved south and north and so on. But that probably, those pressures at that time may have been what, it's my guess, that may have been what accounted for the beginnings of agriculture.
Uh-huh.
And they certainly knew, I mean, if they're hunter-gatherers, somebody's plant-picking plants, then they are actually knowing at what stage they're edible and at what stage they're plantable and what's going on. So they actually knew a lot more about them. I mean, you wouldn't start planting wheat if you hadn't been eating it already.
That's right, yeah. Well, thank you. And by the way, your books are just fascinating.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
We have a couple of other people who are holding on here. We'll get right to them. Do you, I'm interested in this idea that, you know, this idea that maybe an important shaping force in advancing humankind is the willingness to do something different,
yes,
to accept change. And we probably all know people who are really good at that, and some people who aren't.
And some people who aren't.
Do you think that that is, you know, if you were going to make up a list of defining characteristics of modern humankind, would that be an important
thing?
That
would certainly be, because if you take a look at the differences between modern humans, what you call Homo sapiens sapiens, you know, wise man, right?
Of course, we named ourselves.
Yes, right. As opposed to Homo sapiens neanderthalensis, which is the Neanderthal, which is what my clan is based upon. The differences are really not the ones that we think of. I mean, Neanderthal walked just as upright as we do. They had a cranial capacity that was, on average, larger than ours. They were probably physically stronger by 3 or 4 times, at least according to Eric Trinkus and some others who've studied the physical bodies. They had a manual dexterity is at least as good as ours. I mean, the same as ours. There was no question there. The differences that you find are that there was not as much change. You find this very almost resistance to change. And when, you know, if you look at ourselves, if we've been around, okay, since Europe maybe at the earliest about 40,000, now they're beginning to find evidence is perhaps going back as far as 90,000 in Israel. And if Border Cave is effective, then maybe if this very controversial dating of 120,000. But that's, you know, we're really getting controversial. We're saying possibly modern humans have been around, I think the outside they're saying 200,000, moving up out of Africa, maybe. But what we're seeing in the difference is that, number one, for as long as we've been around, at least since Europe, okay, 40,000 years ago, we have effectively changed the face of the earth. We seem to be a people who don't so much adapt to our society and our culture and our world as to make our physical world adapt to us. So we find this tremendous, I mean, what are we, in 40,000 years we have gone from hunting-gathering societies to agriculture, to cities, to technological advances that, No one. I mean, we've traveled, we've taken pictures of Saturn, you know. For good or bad, we've changed the face of our Earth. That's one of the things. The other thing that's interesting, and right along with that, is there's no evidence of art. Before modern humans, there's no evidence of art. And I find that a fascinating definitive difference. You can find evidence of compassion, and because you can find people like my character of Crab, who's based on a Neanderthal skeleton that was blind in one eye and had an arm amputated, you can find evidence of burial, you know, so they must be thinking, you know, where are we going, where are we coming from, you know, or at least the possibility is there that they were thinking. There is one case that some people have doubted, but I've talked to Ralph Solecki, who actually found the site in Iraq, as a matter of fact, of flowers in a grave. And they did it by pollen analysis, of course. And the flowers have an interesting similarity. The things they have in common is that they tend to be rather showy flowers, and that today they have known medicinal values. Hmm. So, you know, you can draw wonderful speculations from that. But there's no evidence of art. And all of a sudden, if they did it on perishable goods. And when we came into the Cro-Magnon or the modern human, suddenly we find evidence of art. And of course, that makes you realize that the same kind of abstracting that you have to do for art is similar to language in its fullest. It's not that they may not have communicated Neanderthals, but if it was in the same way that we do, we don't know.
Well, we have several people here who would like to talk with you. Let me reintroduce, for those of you who may have just joined us, we're talking this morning with author Gene Owl, author of Clan of the Cave Bear, Valley of the Horses, The Mammoth Hunters, and her most recent book is The Plains of Passage. She'll be giving a talk about her writing as part of the MillerCom series tonight on the U of I campus at 8 in the Folinger Auditorium. So if you would like to attend, it's open to the public. Anybody can go. And she will also be doing a book signing this afternoon at the University YWCA, 1001 South Wright Street in Champaign. That's also on the U of I campus. This is co-sponsored by the YW and the Jane Addams Bookshop, so you'll have an opportunity to meet Gene Owl this afternoon. And you can call in here this morning if you have questions for us. The lines are full, but let me give you the number again. It's 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Next caller here, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
I have a question that you started talking about just now, some of the differences and similarities with the Neanderthals and the Cro-Magnon.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that fascinated me in the Clan of the Cave Bear was what I assume were speculations, and I'm beginning to see how you've worked into those, on the differences, mental differences between the two groups and the speech versus sign communication.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And what was really interesting was how did you think up the idea of the memories of the
racial memories?
Yes.
Well, actually, what was happening is that I was finding that there were so many similarities, and between ourselves and the Neanderthals, and yet there were differences. You know, if you take a look at that Neanderthal skull. And I've seen one, you know, mm-hmm. compared with, side by side with the skull of a modern human. And it's huge. It's huge. And not only is the cranial capacity larger, but just the sheer thickness of the bone is much thicker. And it was shaped differently. There were less frontal lobes, and there was this tremendous capacity in the rear of the brain. And I was thinking, why? You know, why is it developed that way? And what really started it out was I got, you know, somewhere in the back of my brain, I think I remember. I mean, how many times have you said that or heard somebody say that, you know? And I thought, wait a minute. Wait. And then, of course, there is this wonderful thing that novelists do. It's called What If, you
yeah.
know? And I began to sort of put the pieces together, and it was a long, evolved kind of a thing before I came to it. But every time I would compare it with what we know about the Neanderthal culture, it did not do a great disservice. I mean, it did not. I mean, I expected to get a tremendous amount of flack from the scientific community. And basically, they say, well, it's pretty much off the wall. But most of them will say it does make an interesting story.
Mm-hmm. I have another question about the planning of the series. Did you start out and with sort of a rough outline that book one would do this and book two would do that all up through the?
I thought I was writing a short story, and then it turned into a novel, and I thought it was going to be one big fat novel in six parts, because once I got into the research and got my whole excitement, my imagination was so fired up, and I almost, you know, I kept thinking, why don't we know this stuff? Why do we have this misimpression? Why do we think that somehow these people were less complex, did not have the same kinds of feelings and emotions? And yes, that was coming through to me in all the scientific material. I mean, it was just standing up and grabbing me. And then I thought, okay, it's because it's not accessible, because the scientific material is fairly dense and fairly dry and turgid. And I thought it needs to be told in a story.
Mm-hmm. And how did you come to the subject altogether?
Your guess is as good as mine. I mean it sincerely. Actually, what happened is that it just came. It was one of those ideas that came to me one day, and I had never written. I mean, I'd written poetry. I'd never written fiction. And I was in between jobs. I'd quit my job. I'd just gotten my MBA. I was 40 years old. I was off to do great, wonderful things in business. And I'd quit the job, just kind of trying to decide what it is I wanted to do with my life, and got this idea for a story, and that's what headed me off into the research. And basically what happened is I sat down and then wrote what I thought was one novel, that when I went back to look at it, I realized that I didn't have one, I had six. So I do have that first rough draft of the novel as my outline for the whole six-book series.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I'm glad you got distracted from the MBA.
Thank you. Me
okay.
too.
Thank you for let's talk with somebody else here. We'll go to line number two.
Me.
Yes.
My questions are not profound, and the lady just prior to me got.
I'll
turn down.
Yeah, turn down the radio for us. Thanks.
The lady just prior to me got a lot of the answers I want. I just want to know how far along are we on number five?
I've been still doing research, and I will tell you that one of the things I'm doing right now for research is learning French. And the reason I'm learning French is because there's so much material that's only in French and it's not translated.
Oh, good. Well, I just want these to be finished before I'm gone.
I'll try. I want to get them done before I'm gone, too.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed them.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you for the call. Pretty soon you're going to have to start getting some honorary PhDs.
I have three.
Oh, you do have?
I do have three, yes.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
No, you should have known. We'll probably get you some more by the time you finish learning French. Let's go on here. We'll go to the toll-free line once again. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Recently, a person was describing Africa, and he said the curse of Africa was the Garden of Eden compared to the temperate zone, Germany and Europe, where they had to have their harvests in before the frost, warm clothing and shelter, and this gave them leisure in the winter to develop technology, and that was the reason that part of the world developed so much faster than the warmer climates of Africa.
That's a possibility, especially if you're talking about technologically, but I think then, again, you have to talk about socially, too. And the cultures in Africa and the cultures in Australia and the cultures, the native cultures anyplace, actually developed a very, very complex and interesting and fascinating internal and social cultures. And we cannot say that just because we're technologically doing rocket ships that we're necessarily more intelligent. It's just a different way of a different place to put your emphasis, that's all.
Well, it's interesting that the first immigrants were people from the temperate climate that could survive in that area here.
But, of course, you know, if you're talking about advances and you're looking at the hunting-gathering societies, even in America at the time, if you start looking at some of the Aztecs and some of the early South American, where it was warm, and yet they had developed a very, very advanced culture, which was then, of course, wiped out. We're talking about something in terms of history of no more than a couple thousand years difference. And I think that if there hadn't been that invasion, the same kinds of things would have probably developed on this continent.
Thank you.
Oh, and I thank you for the call. Let's go on here. Line three would be next. Hello.
Hello. I have a question, actually a couple. First, I want to say again, as everyone else, that I've really enjoyed all of your books.
Thank you very much.
I was wondering if you're seeing, it looks like through the books you're getting, touching on the subject of the replacement of Neanderthal by Cro-Magnon. I've read several books in the same genre, mm-hmm. and one of the books, Dance of the Tiger, explored that, the replacement of them with the hybridization and eventually, you know, sterility of the, you know, what in your case mm-hmm. with the clan and the others.
Mm-hmm.
Will something like this be explored, or is that not what you...
Well, let me say that that's not something. I've read Bjorn Kjartan's Dance of the Tiger, and I found it a very interesting book, especially since we were both sort of talking about the same point. I mean, his is a book about about a Cro-Magnon boy raised by Neanderthal, and mine's a Cro-Magnon girl raised by Neanderthals. I do have to say that I found his particular theory when I really, you see, I'm not a scientist. I am an intelligent human being. And when I write stories, I have to make my characters move in a logical way and in with motivation. And when I looked at his story, which is really based, was his scientific model that he was then developing into a novel, it just didn't work for me. And the reason that it didn't work for me was, first of all, you know, his theory basically was that yes, the Neanderthal and the Cro-Magnon were able to breed, but that the offspring was sterile like a mule. And his other part of his theory was based on the idea that a concept called neoteny, which really means that as we become more evolved, we look younger. In other words, we probably resemble puppies more than adult dogs because puppies have round heads and flat noses and faces. And, of course, as they become adults.
Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Hello.
I have a question, actually a couple. First, I want to say again, as everyone else, that I've really enjoyed all of your books.
Thank you very much.
I was wondering if you're seeing, it looks like through the books you're getting, touching on the subject of the replacement of Neanderthal by Cro-Magnon. I've read several books in the same genre,
mm-hmm.
and one of the books, Dance of the Tiger, explored that, the replacement of them with the hybridization and eventually, you know, sterility of the, you know, what in your case mm-hmm. with the clan and the others.
Mm-hmm.
Will something like this be explored, or is that not what you...
Well, let me say that that's not something. I've read Bjorn Kjartan's Dance of the Tiger, and I found it a very interesting book, especially since we were both sort of talking about the same point. I mean, his is a book about about a Cro-Magnon boy raised by Neanderthal, and mine's a Cro-Magnon girl raised by Neanderthals. I do have to say that I found his particular theory... when I really, you see, I'm not a scientist. I am an intelligent human being. And when I write stories, I have to make my characters move in a logical way and in with motivation. And when I looked at his story, which is really based, was his scientific model that he was then developing into a novel, it just didn't work for me. And the reason that it didn't work for me was, first of all, you know, his theory basically was that yes, the Neanderthal and the Cro-Magnon were able to breed, but that the offspring was sterile like a mule. And his other part of his theory was based on the idea that a concept called neoteny, which really means that as we become more evolved, we look younger. In other words, we probably resemble puppies more than adult dogs because puppies have round heads and flat noses and faces. And, of course, as they become adult, they become elongated. That's kind of the concept. It's a simplistic way of explaining it. And so his theory was really that the Neanderthal women saw all of these Cro-Magnon men who came in from another part of the world, from the east or the south. His Neanderthal were blonde. The Cro-Magnon were dark haired and dark-skinned, and he proposed that these Neanderthal women were so attracted to these Cro-Magnon men because they resembled babies, because they were younger, that therefore they basically ignored their own males and only wanted to mate with these Cro-Magnon males, and the offspring were sterile, and therefore that accounted for the demise of Neanderthal. And when I start looking at this in just plain, ordinary human common sense terms, I'm saying, what are all these Neanderthal men doing while their women are only going off with these Cro-Magnon men? And how are these Neanderthal women attracting all of these Cro-Magnon men? And what are all the Cro-Magnon women doing at that time? And that women are not usually attracted to babyish-looking men. They're attracted to maturity, not youth, because they need something that's going to be helpful to them in the raising of their family. And how long does it take before they figure out there aren't any grandchildren? And when I start putting human motivation into that theory, it just doesn't work for me.
Right, so we'll just...
So that doesn't, you know, but he did a lot of other interesting things in his book, I think the thing I liked best was that he made his black tiger. I also had trouble with a black tiger in a country that was basically either snowy or grassland, and I thought that the black would not have been a very good color for camouflage, but the lions in the grassland tend to be very tawny colored, so I had trouble with that too, but I loved the six toes. I mean,
yes.
Cats have six toes, and he made his cat with six toes, and I loved it.
Do you, with your...
Sometimes cats have six toes, I should say.
With your characters, I was wondering, will Ayla come to grips with her mental abilities, her seeing, calling game?
I'm not telling. You
not
have to wait
tell.
And see.
And her shamanism or parent. Okay.
Obviously, you can see a direction we're heading, yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks
for the call. What do you think about the theory that, in fact, maybe the Cro-Magnon murdered off Neanderthal?
No. I think it's far too simplistic. My thought is that probably it was very complex. There were a lot of things that came into play. Some of it may have been very similar to what happened to the Native Americans on this continent when we were invaded, when the Europeans invaded, that there was probably perhaps some disease, perhaps some violence, perhaps some other kinds of things, but there was a lot of interbreeding. And that there was, and I think that there's too much evidence, particularly in Central Europe, showing even as late as Neolithic cemeteries, skeletons that have what they call archaic characteristics, and I've seen some of those in Czechoslovakia, and I think that there was certainly a melding, and that the offspring were very much viable.
All right, let's talk with someone else. Line number one. Hello.
Oh, just a comment on your caller a moment ago who was speculating on reasons for civilization having developed in Germany in the north.
Mm-hmm.
He seems to have his facts wrong. That isn't where civilization first appeared.
Euphrates Triangle.
And in tropical America.
Yes, in tropical America too.
And there are traces of it, of course, in North Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah.
So I'm afraid he has a major problem with his premise.
Well, that is a premise that people have tried to come up with before, and
it's very gratifying to us European immigrants.
Yes, of course.
Immigrants.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
Thanks for the call. Somebody else here over to our toll-free line again. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I'd like to ask your guest if she's familiar with a book called Ab the First Man, which I read in junior high school, maybe 60 years ago.
Oh, my. No, I'm not, but I have to tell you that I have been making a collection, and I have a nice little collection started of stories that have been written some time ago about the evolution and about early humans. For example, Jack London wrote one called Before Adam, which most people don't realize, and there was actually a book written by... what is the name? Johannes Jensen, that won a Nobel Prize. It was a series of three books called The Long Journey, and the first one was called Fire and Ice, and that was about... But that was written like in 1920s or before.
Well, this must have been written in the 20s because, you know, I read it maybe in 1931 or 32 or something like that. And, of course, there's been so much research done in the past half century that would change everything. But I just wondered, if you were familiar with it, and I was wondering what you might have to say about it.
Well, I wish I were. That's not one that I am familiar with.
But you might try to find it. It was just capital A, capital B, the first man. I mean, that was his name.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Okay. All right, thank you.
We have about 10 minutes left with Jean Al, and if you want, again, to call in, if you'd like to talk with her, please do take the opportunity. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Do you think if things might have been a little bit different in your life, that you would, in fact, have been an anthropologist and chosen the scientific career?
I love science, and I have probably from the very beginning. Of course, I was born in Chicago. I'm actually I was from Illinois in the beginning. Moved to Oregon after I got married, but basically, I've always had an interest in science. And there was a time when I got married at 18 and graduated from high school, and then had five kids, and then I went back to college. And I was 28 when I started, and I thought I was going to be a physicist. I was taking physics and math. I have math through differential equations and physics and some electronics and so on and so forth. And then I got off into this business thing. But I've always been interested in science of one form or another. And, yes, I think anthropology and archaeology are fascinating. I'm doing it my way, that's all.
So something else I wanted to ask you, and, you know, I know, again, as we've talked, you have done a lot of research and read very widely to get the knowledge you have you put in your books. And I'm wondering if you're familiar with the work of Rhian Eisler.
Yes, I have. I've met her a couple of times.
She has been on the program a couple of times by phone. I have not met her personally, but have been interested in
Chalice
and
the Blade. Yeah.
Chalice and the Blade.
Well, she's interesting. I have a little trouble with some of her because the area that I am very familiar with is the area that I'm writing about. And, of course, I know the general evolutionary theory because I have to know where my area fits, you know, and what is the scientific feeling about it all. I do find that I have a little trouble with some of her early, when she makes in her book, and I read it, she has a little, she's not exactly entirely accurate with some of all of the facts, but she's gotten it from places. I mean, she's done her research, and sometimes all of the sources, especially if they're older sources, are not so accurate. Got to be very careful with copyright dates anymore when you're doing research in this period. I think she's got an interesting theory. It has to do with the fact that basically it's only been in the last 5,000 years that we became so warlike, and that we can, if we think about it, to come back to a more partnership sort of world. And I like it. I think it sounds good. I can't guarantee I can't be certain that that's really the way it was. But on the other hand, there's a lot of evidence, I think, to indicate that things were more equally structured in earlier times.
Mm-hmm. That's something that interests me, just to find out how you have thought about that, the whole business of relations between men and women and gender roles, and how you think that these people work those things out.
Well, you know, I came up with a whole set of, I was trying to, in the beginning, trying to come up with a kind of culture that's different from today's. And of course, we have a patriarchal culture, you know. And I started to really just look, and I thought to myself, what if this was, you know, I mean, this time so long ago before people really even fully understood the male role in procreation, you know, what kind of a culture would that evolve? And we have to remember that even the so-called primitive, which I don't even like that word, but the less technologically advanced peoples of today's world have just as long a history as we do. They've gone through as many changes as we have, you know. And we don't know, as the one caller was saying, we were talking about sub-Saharan Africa and some of those ruins that are in that region. I just think that probably things were more equal in earlier days, yes.
Okay, let's talk with somebody else. Our toll-free line again. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I tuned in late, and two things. One, I didn't get the times. I teach at EIU, which is about 50 miles south. Can you give me again, when is she signing books and what's going on?
Sure, I can
I
do that.
I wasn't aware that this was going on. I just was driving home to the farm and heard this. It's great.
Well, for you and everybody else, I'll just mention again, she's going to be giving a MillerCom talk. It's just a very fine lecture series on this campus, and that will be at 8 o'clock tonight in the Follinger Auditorium, which is on the south end of the quad, for anybody who is familiar with the campus. And it's free. Anybody who would like to go can attend. And then she's also doing a book signing this afternoon from 2 to 4 at the University YMCA, which is at on Wright Street, south 1001 South Wright in Champaign.
And that's 2 to 4?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, the other thing, if I make it up there, I'm an artist, and I've thought, you know, over the years of sending something to Jean. Can you leave an address there that I can?
You can always send something.
However you do that.
Yeah, you can always send something if you and you have to look. You can send it by way of the publisher, and they always forward to me.
Oh, they do.
Yeah, but you have to make sure that you look at the address in the most recent book. You know, go into a bookstore or whatever, because they've moved. And the people who are sending things to the address that's in the Clan of the Cave Bear first books are getting them returned. So you know that you look in the Plains of Passage if you want to look for the address.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, and this is great that you're doing this. Okay.
Thank you.
Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Let's go on here. Someone on one of our local lines, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Ms. Al, I'd just like to say I really enjoy your use of dreams in the books, the way that that you use that to give insight and advance the plot and sort of give clues as to what's coming ahead.
Thank you.
That's one of my particular favorite things. I really enjoyed your books a lot. As we sort of passed them around the family, you know.
Oh, good. That's great.
Yeah.
Well, dreams, I think that people, it's an interesting thing. When I write the books, I try to write them from the point of view that anything that's occult, anything that has to do with the spiritualism or the shamanism, it's very much understood that this is what those people, the characters in the story, believe. And I oftentimes try to give a hint of why they might take something that we perhaps know differently today, and then they might interpret it in another way. On the other hand, I'm not sure that I have a total handle on that spiritual world, and I think that some of the shamanistic practices may have insights that we don't even know about. So while I have always tried to be very careful to keep the scientific element of it foremost, I'm sure that people who lived in those times certainly did have a spiritual sense, and so that's one of the things that I've tried to do.
Well, it adds so much depth to the story and the characters that that you don't often see in books.
Thank you.
And that's really a wonderful thing. We're really glad that you're here.
Good.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. We'll get, I think, probably one more person here. We'll go to our toll-free line again. Hello.
Yes. I wonder if your guest has, I got in a little late, has read Golding's The Inheritors.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
What did you think of that?
Well, I think that Golding, obviously William Golding, is a fine and very wonderful writer. His book is now about, 45 years ago that it was written. And he was writing about a period in time when the ideas of who our early ancestors are have been changed since that time. As a matter of fact, his character that's sort of based on Neanderthal are still sort of walking around on all fours, which was a theory that they had at one time. Nonetheless, it's still a marvelous, poignant, moving story, and it'll never lose that, no matter what.
I was very interested in the fact that the Neanderthal baby is going to be brought up by the Cro-Magnon people at the end.
At the end, yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if you know another little book called The Gift of Stones.
No, I'm not familiar with that.
it's about the Stone Age, the end of the Stone Age. Oh, and then also, I wonder if you've ever read Ridley Walker by Hoban.
I've heard of it, but no, I haven't read it.
It's very interesting because it goes to the other end of things when everything is pretty much destroyed and these people are falling back into what might be considered a kind of stone age, a new stone age. One other question. What do you feel, or what is the latest thing on a man beginning in Africa, and what would his race be then? Would he be like Lucy? Would he be necessarily black?
Of course, nobody knows the skin color was, but the chances are that if it's out of Africa, that people may have been black. There is, of course, a theory that as you moved into Northern Europe and your black skin does not absorb vitamin D as readily as fair skin, and I think it's something like 10 minutes of sunlight on the face of a fair-skinned person where you'll have enough vitamin D and you don't store it. So that there would have been a selective advantage in fairer skin, so that perhaps as people move north, that may have accounted for it. That's at least one theory. There does seem to be generally a theory that people did move out of Africa, and I don't know when. There's a lot of controversy about whether it was only modern humans or whether it was way back in Homo erectus, that's sort of up for grabs.
We're at the point here where we're going to have to stop. I'm sorry to say we've used up all of our time. Is it really true, by the way, that as you travel around the country, you meet little girls who are named Ayla?
Yes.
Actually naming their children after your character?
Yes, as a matter of fact, it's wonderful. There was one signing in Santa Clara, California, where it was a two-hour signing, and there were five little girls between the ages of 4 months and 7 years that their parents brought up that were named Ayla.
Says something about the popularity of your...
Well, I hope it's
work.
Because they feel that the characters of the characteristics and the qualities of the character are something that they feel important.
Well, again, we will tell people that if you would like to hear more from Jean Owl, she'll be giving a talk on the U of I campus tonight at 8 in the Follinger Auditorium. That's on the south end of the quad. Let me also mention a companion lecture, which I have neglected here and I should not have, that will be given by an anthropologist who's part of the faculty here at the U of I, a woman named Olga Sofer.
In that field, I have to tell you, Olga Sofer is acknowledged by the community, archaeological community, is the best when it comes to Eastern and Central Europe.
And we better say that because she's probably listening. She'll be giving companion talk, talking about some of the scientific evidence about life in this period. And this will be on Thursday of this week at noon at the Center for Advanced Study on the U of I campus, which is at 912 West Illinois. And again, anybody who would like to attend that is certainly welcome to do that. Thank you very much for being here. It's been
Thank you so much. This has been great.